This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. Earlier this morning, the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments for a case that came out of Oregon. Grants Pass v. Johnson could reshape the way cities and states all across the country respond to homelessness. In a few minutes, we'll talk to a legal scholar about what actually happened at the oral arguments. But we start with some background on this case. Jeremiah Hayden is a reporter for Street Roots. He covered this story in Grants Pass and was at the Supreme Court earlier this morning. Jeremiah, welcome.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. How did this case start?
This case started in 2018. The Oregon Law Center filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of Deborah Blake. Deborah Blake ultimately passed away in 2021, and Gloria Johnson and John Logan stepped in as class representatives as the case made its way through the appeals process. The city of Grants Pass had basically made it impossible for homeless people to exist in the city limits at all without being punished with civil or criminal penalties.
What does the city of Grants Pass want to do?
Well, sort of explicitly, they want people to move out of the city. People are required to move every 72 hours. Officers come to parks every Monday and Thursday, hand out eviction notices, give tickets. Code explicitly bars anyone from sleeping in public spaces. That includes parks, sidewalks, in cars, or using any sleeping materials, and for what they say is the purpose of maintaining a temporary place to live.
So what are the plaintiffs, what are homeless residents arguing?
Well, the question at the center of this is whether these ordinances, constitute cruel and unusual punishment. Grants Pass says that the criminal punishments are necessary tools for enforcing the laws banning homeless people from public spaces. But the lawyers and the, homeless residents in Grants Pass say that those penalties against people who have nowhere else to go is cruel and unusual punishment, which violates the Eighth Amendment.
There is one shelter in Grants Pass, but it's fairly restrictive. What are the rules?
The Gospel Rescue Mission is a religious organization. It is not an emergency shelter where someone can just show up, get a place for the night. There are none of those actually in Grants Pass until last week when the city actually voted to open one. But the Gospel Rescue Mission opened in 1983. And it requires people to abstain from substances, which includes nicotine. People have to attend daily Christian services, turn over all of their medications. It doesn't allow socializing with the opposite sex, except to approved events. And of course, gender and sexuality is acknowledged in what they call biblical terms.
Are there any other options right now for people experiencing homelessness in Grants Pass? I mean, this gets to the question of scale. I mean, of the people who are homeless right now and the options that are available to them.
Right. Yeah, that is sort of a main point because, Martin v. Boise is another Ninth Circuit court decision that serves as the backdrop for this case. And that one says that if you can't criminalize people when they have no place to go, but that also implies that if people have a place to go, then you can, establish your time, place, and manner ordinances. So the city council, with some resistance from, people who didn't necessarily want a shelter in their backyard for many years now, did last week actually vote for this organization, Mint, to open a navigation center, which can also act as an emergency shelter during inclement weather, which would sort of adhere to local laws about, when certain thresholds are met for weather. But really, literally, there isn't a place where someone within the city of Grants Pass can say, I'd like to sleep inside tonight rather than outside, and then just simply go there.
The city was pretty transparent about wanting to make things difficult for homeless people in Grants Pass so that they would go elsewhere. There's a quote that's gotten a lot of attention that you read about, that the New York Times picked it up as well, from 2013. I'm curious about what you heard more recently from residents in Grants Pass, both housed and unhoused, about the current tensions there.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension there, and it's not unlike anywhere else in the United States, where, you know, people are concerned about crime and homelessness kind of gets wrapped into this sort of tough on crime rhetoric. It's really unfortunate because people experiencing homelessness are disproportionately, you know, disabled people, people of color, Black people, LGBTQIA people. School children, you know, Josephine County has 756 school-age children who are homeless, you know. And so, you know, this is kind of, you know, this is a big piece of that. But then, you know, so the house residents are really, really bringing this this crime stuff into play and not wanting this kind of stuff to come into their backyard. You know, the homeless residents in the city are, as ever, sort of arguing, like, we need to have a place to go. They have, the city's turned off the water at times, the restrooms are closed, and sort of, it sort of produces a sort of stereotypical version of homelessness that people might sort of imagine. Simply the ordinance themselves simply produce, you know, that result.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking right now about the Grants Pass v. Johnson case that was heard this morning, oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court. Obviously, and as you mentioned, these issues have played out up and down, well, all over the country, but to a great extent up and down the West Coast. Why do you think it's a case out of Grants Pass that made it all the way to the Supreme Court?
It's interesting, yeah. The sort of facts in the case, you know, kind of the there's maybe no other place that's quite as explicit, you know, as of a decade ago, about what the intentions are, about making people so uncomfortable. You know, for one, the Oregon Law Center filed this case, and I did talk to Ed Johnson after arguments today. He's the lawyer from the Oregon Law Center who opened this case in 2018. And he said, you know, you can't plan on something like this going to the court. It's just sort of statistically, you know, who knows what's ever going to happen with that. But the things are, the ordinance itself is just so explicit in what it's trying to do to people that it's sort of inevitable that it would end up becoming a Eighth Amendment case about cruel and unusual punishment.
What was the scene like outside the courthouse this morning before oral arguments?
There was actually a demonstration out there. I wasn't able to be there because I was going inside the court for oral arguments at about the same time. But there was a lot of joy, honestly. There was music playing. People were laughing. And then they were staging, the National Homelessness Law Center put together to stage a lie-in. They called it a lie-in, where they would sort of demonstrate what it is that Grants Pass is trying to criminalize, with people with laying out with blankets. So there were a lot of people out there. When I went inside the court, a few people actually even commented, it's not very common that people are out there early in the morning, but this is a real catalyzing moment for people who are trying to work on the homelessness crisis in America.
Did you talk to any folks who actually went to D.C. from Oregon or elsewhere in the West Coast specifically so they could be there for oral arguments?
I did. I met Helen Cruz when I was in Grants Pass. She was the first person I spoke to, and I had talked with her public defender, who really helped, you know, explain the difficulty of the sort of constant way of just being ticketed simply for being homeless in Grants Pass. And I talked to Helen. I texted with her last night, just to see, if she made it into town. The Homelessness Law Center had flown her out to sort of represent the people back home. And she said, she was very inspired by this. She said she was just so inspired, has this new sense of hope, meeting with all of these people who are working to help the most vulnerable among us. And she said she had almost given up on the idea that anyone even cared, and then said her faith in humanity has been restored. A few minutes right before I came on here, she actually sent me a few photos too of homeless Grants Pass residents who demonstrated with signs outside the Josephine County Courthouse this morning at the same time the US Supreme Court was hearing arguments. This is a really big moment for people to be able to connect, because these are in many ways local issues, but kind of all politics is local all the way to this national crisis that we all see.
What'd you hear from lawyers from either side after oral arguments?
Yeah, I think we have some tape from Ed Johnson if we want to play that tape.
It's a good case to have in front of the Supreme Court. There are important issues, and the facts in this case are just so egregious that, if the court's going to hear it, this is a good case for them to hear it.
He was really encouraged by the way that the justices were actually asking really critical, really thoughtful questions. And I felt the same way, that there was, there was a lot of talk about sort of the status versus the conduct and where to draw the line between a status, an involuntary status that a person can't help, and the conduct that results from that status. And I felt that, really all of the justices had a really, really interesting conversations, sort of with the lawyers, but they're of course talking to each other. And I thought that he told me that he felt really encouraged by how well that went and how seriously they took the case for the people who are experiencing homelessness in America.
Jeremiah, thanks.
Thanks, Dave, so much for having me.
Jeremiah Hayden is a reporter for Street Roots. If you're just tuning in, we're talking right now about the Grants Pass v. Johnson case that was heard this morning at the U.S. Supreme Court. It could reshape the way cities and states all across the country respond to homelessness. We're going to turn now to an analysis of the oral arguments. Sarah Rankin is a professor at Seattle University School of Law and the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. We talked about 2 hours ago, right after the oral arguments ended. I started by having her remind us about the Ninth Circuit's 2018 ruling in Martin v. Boise. It's a case that came up a lot in the back and forths.
The Martin v. Boise case was decided in 2020, 2018. And it was a case that decided whether it was constitutional for the city of Boise to criminally punish or charge people criminally for camping in public space when there were no reasonable alternatives. In other words, when the city lacked sufficient shelter. And the Ninth Circuit in that case said, no, that's not constitutional under the Eighth Amendment, which is the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. And so that case stands for the proposition that you can't punish people for the unavoidable consequences of being human. And the Martin Court applied that to protect people who were involuntarily homeless in the city of Boise, to protect them from being criminally punished for surviving outside when the city lacked sufficient shelter for them.
This was a Ninth Circuit ruling, meaning affecting basically the entire West Coast, a bunch of states. Are there any other similar rulings in effect in the rest of the country? I'm wondering if other states in the Midwest or the South or the East have similar legal regimes.
Well, there have been cases in other circuits that have rendered decisions based on Martin or have cited Martin. And the 11th Circuit, for example, and the 4th Circuit, both have rendered decisions that take Martin's holding into account.
Can you give us a sense for just the breadth of cities and states and other jurisdictions who filed amicus briefs in support of Grant's Pass? I mean, it, in some ways, it seems like a who's who of the American West.
Yeah, there's tens of them, right? I mean, I think it's something like 39 amicus briefs. Don't quote me on that. I don't know. It's an awful lot. And what's unique about the amicus briefs in support of the city of Grants Pass is that they had bipartisan support. So there were sort of politically oriented entities that could be construed as both conservative and as progressive in favor of the Grants Pass appeal.
So let's turn to the arguments themselves. So many of the back and forths touched in one way or another on a more than 60-year-old ruling called Robinson. What is it, and why was this so central to the proceedings today?
Yeah, Robinson is a 1962 U.S. Supreme Court case that held that it's unconstitutional to punish someone for their status. And in that case in particular, what they were looking at was drug addiction. And so the line that the court drew there was to say it's unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment to criminalize someone, in other words, to charge them criminally just because they're being a drug addict. There has to be conduct, and that has to be conduct, for example, they said it is constitutional to punish someone for using drugs, but not for being a drug addict. And so the issue there is that it's really inhumane. It violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment to punish someone for unavoidable circumstances that they can't control, like their own status, or it's the unavoidable consequence of one's status or being.
I want to play a contentious back and forth between Justice Sotomayor and Theanne Evangelist Kapur, the Los Angeles-based lawyer representing Grants Pass. Let's have a listen.
It's only stopping you from sleeping in public if you, for the purpose of maintaining a temporary place to live. And the police officers testified that that means that if a stargazer wants to take a blanket or a sleeping bag out at night to watch the stars and falls asleep, you don't arrest them. You don't arrest babies who have blankets over them. You don't arrest people who are sleeping on the beach, as I tend to do if I've been there a while. You only arrest people who don't have a second home. Is that correct?
Well,
who don't have a home.
So, no, these laws are generally applicable. They apply to
everyone. Yeah, that's what you want to say. Give me one example, because your police officers couldn't, and they explicitly said, if someone has another home, has a home, and is out there and happens to fall asleep, they won't be arrested. Fall asleep with something on them.
Well, Joint Appendix, page 98, is one example of a citation issued to a person with a home address. But more importantly, I think what we're getting at here is that these laws regulate conduct of everyone. There's nothing in the law that criminalizes homelessness.
That's what you say, but if I look at the record and see differently.
What was Justice Sotomayor getting at here? I mean, what is the heart of her questions?
She's really driving at whether what the city of Grants Pass is trying to do is to punish somebody for their status as opposed to their conduct. So if anyone engages in illegal conduct, the conduct itself is punishable, right? That's something that can be punished. But if somebody is being punished for their status, in other words, other people can engage in the same conduct, but the law is only being applied, or you know, they're targeting certain groups, then the way that the law is functioning is to punish people for their status as opposed to the conduct. There were a lot of really heated examples like that. I think another example that was brought up later on was how frequently people can go into the park and sit down and have a picnic with a blanket. Those people are not going to be fined for sleeping in public, even if they fall asleep. But if somebody appears to be homeless, not only do they are they more likely to get cited? But in the city of Grants Pass, people have been cited so many multiples of times that they are shouldering thousands of dollars in debt. Some of the named plaintiffs have over $5,000 in debt just from existing in public space illegally. And those citations can over time turn into criminal charges for criminal trespass. So we're talking about fining and ticketing, but also in a way that initially what might seem like a civil law issue then turns into a criminal law issue.
Let's listen to another question. This is from Justice Jackson, and referencing that 60-year-old ruling, Robinson.
It seems both cruel and unusual to punish people for acts that constitute basic human needs. So here, unlike in Robinson, where, you know, you had at least the sort of disease state, drugs and the like, and potentially culpable acts that relate to that disease state, here we're talking about sleeping that is universal, that is a basic function. And so I guess what I don't understand is, in this circumstance, why that particular state is being considered conduct for the purpose of punishment.
How did the lawyer for Grants Pass, or just in general, how do proponents of Grants Pass's policies, how do they respond to this basic question from Justice Jackson?
Not very well. I thought that the counsel for the city of Grants Pass really struggled with answers to that one, because Jackson and several of the other justices construed the law, I think fairly, since the law prohibits sleeping outside, the definition of homelessness is sleeping outside because you don't have a reasonable alternative, because you lack a fixed address. And so the Grants Pass Council really struggled with answering how that wasn't something that was applied unfairly, or that targeted people who were experiencing homelessness. The other thing I think that's really important here is all of these sorts of arguments are really trying to push at whether homelessness is being punished as a status. And what I think that the counsel for the original plaintiffs did really, really well, the respondent in this case, was say that, you know, people should not be excused from engaging in otherwise criminal activity or criminal conduct if anyone who did it would be in trouble. So some of the justices asked, well, what if somebody needed food and so they stole food? And the counsel for the plaintiff said that would be a problem. That would not be covered under the Eighth Amendment, because anyone would be punished because that's otherwise criminal conduct. Stealing food is otherwise criminal conduct. Sleeping is a universal human need, and you cannot punish someone for engaging in the unavoidable consequence of being human. You can't punish someone for undertaking a necessary life-sustaining activity. So that's really what was at issue in that clip.
One of the issues that a few conservative justices brought up, Justice Thomas did, the Chief Justice Roberts, I think, brought this up as well, is that homelessness is a state or a status that can change frequently. It you can go in and out of being homeless. They made it a point to pin down various counsel on this. Why? What's at stake in that question legally?
They're trying to press counsel to really test the elasticity of this idea of status, right? The idea of status is it's easiest to identify someone's status if it's something that can't be changed. For example, someone's race. That sort of inquiry has gotten really messy in contemporary times because, for example, gender used to be one of those statuses that folks thought was immutable. But now we understand that that gender can be fluid. And so those that sort of inquiry is really pushing at sort of the clearer cases in the law where you're really focusing on status. If it's status, it's easiest to identify it's if it's something that can't be changed.
But to what end? I mean, is the real reason for poking there to say that if something is immutable, if it can change, then we should give less deference to defenses based on that status? Is that the real point of it?
The real point of it, in addition to trying to figure out whether it's a status versus a conduct thing, is to see if there's a voluntariness to it. And so, in other words, if someone is homeless because they've declined an offer of shelter, that is a circumstance where the justices and even the city of Grants Pass would say, actually, everybody agrees that those sorts of circumstances are actually not covered in this case. For people who are involuntarily homeless, the Eighth Amendment would apply. But for people who are voluntarily homeless, in other words, they're making a decision to be homeless when they could change their own circumstances, that's when the Eighth Amendment wouldn't apply.
I'd love
because
to play
it's going a, back to choice.
Let's play a back and forth. It's a little bit long, but I think it's worth it. That gets to this. It's a question about choices and human actions. This is Justice Alito asking questions, actually, of the lawyer for the plaintiffs, Kelsey Corcoran, who is also the Supreme Court Director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. This is the back and forth. Justice Alito will speak first.
If the reason why the person finds himself or herself in that status is, for example, the person refuses to take antipsychotic medicine that's been prescribed, or refuses to go to drug rehab or rehabilitation for alcoholism, or the person has chosen to move from one place where the person might have a shelter or a home where the person could live to another place. What about all of that?
So the status of homelessness is something that only changes once the person has a home. You lose your home, you're homeless. If you have a home again, then you're not in the status anymore. I think what your question gets at is that second piece, which is whether a person has access to shelter. That can change from day to day. And so—
Now, that's not really what my question gets at. The question is, you can draw a distinction. Status is different from conduct. But there are some instances of conduct that are closely tied to status, or if homelessness is defined as simply lacking a place to stay on a particular night, they amount to the same thing. The definition of homelessness encompasses the conduct of sleeping outside. So my question is whether this is, what if the person finds that person in a homeless state because of prior life choices or the refusal to make future life choices? That's the question.
Yeah. So our definition of lacking access to shelter is lacking physical or legal access to shelter, and you're looking at the person's situation on that particular night. I think generally we're not doing an inquiry into all of a person's life choices that might have led them to the point where they're homeless and can't find a place to sleep. Robinson certainly didn't do that sort of analysis with respect to addiction. But there could be situations where there is such a tight causal nexus between a choice a person has made and their lack of shelter access that you would say this person has chosen not to take the shelter. And to be very clear, if you decline shelter that is physically and legally available to you, you're not in our class.
What stands out to you in that exchange, both the ideas behind Justice Alito's question and the response from the plaintiff's lawyer?
I think the plaintiff's lawyer, counsel there, did a beautiful job of really clarifying that this case is really just about the applicability of the Eighth Amendment prohibition against punishing people for involuntary conditions, right? So something that's unavoidable. What Alito was really driving at there was, well, you know, where do we draw that line? If someone made a bad decision, you know, years before, or in the future, they're going to make a bad decision, how much does their bad decision, their culpability for their own situation, discrimination play into things. And counsel there made it clear that the definition of accessibility, whether somebody has that choice, whether the shelter that's offered to them or if there is available shelter, whether that shelter is physically and legally available. And so there was some sparring there in that circumstance around people. One of the harder hypotheticals is around people who have severe untreated mental illness. Because, as counsel goes on to say later in that clip, which you didn't play, there are circumstances where legally and physically you cannot have people with severe untreated mental illness in certain congregate shelters. One, there are congregate shelters that explicitly exclude those folks. And in other cases, there are circumstances where forcing people with severe untreated mental illness into a congregate shelter is not only potentially harmful for others in that space, but it's potentially and often demonstrably harmful to the person who's being forced into that space. And that's when the counsel for the plaintiffs pointed to the fact that in those instances, there's probably other legal avenues like the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that would apply. So there are other, basically the point she was trying to make is that the line that's clearest here is whether there is a shelter, whether there's a space for someone to go to that is physically and legally available to them.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking right now with Sarah Rankin, associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. We are talking about the oral arguments in the Oregon-based Supreme Court case that just happened this morning in Washington, D.C. I want to actually play another clip from Justice Alito. In general, the conservative justices today seemed more favorable to the arguments made by the lawyer for the city of Grants Pass, but it wasn't absolute. And this is one of the exchanges that shows sort of how complicated this was if you were thinking about a kind of a strict partisan matrix. Let's have a listen.
Robinson presents a very difficult conceptual question. Do you think that someone who is a drug addict is absolutely incapable of, that all people who are drug addicts are absolutely incapable of refraining from using drugs?
I think that for some that may be true, and for some perhaps they can abstain, but that's a question of free will and agency that's true of every law and what conduct we choose to regulate. That's
all right. Then compare that with a person who absolutely has no place to sleep in a particular jurisdiction. Does that person have any alternative other than sleeping outside?
So I think we'd have to ask all of the questions I mentioned earlier about what alternatives they might have had yesterday.
No, they have, and they how have they ended none. Up. They have absolutely none. There's not a single place where they can sleep.
If that's true, then that may be the case. And in that case, at least in Oregon, they would have a defense of necessity.
So the point is that the connection between drug addiction and drug usage is more tenuous than the connection between absolute homelessness and sleeping outside.
What is the necessity defense that the Grants Pass counsel there brought up? It came up a number of times over the course of the 2 hours or so of oral argument.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, in terms of Alito, what the point he was trying to make there is that the Robinson decision that held that it's unconstitutional to punish someone for being a drug addict because that's a status, Alito and other justices made that point repeatedly, that they think that this case is actually a clearer case where it's a status rather than what had been decided in Robinson. So that you gave a good example of Alito sort of surprising me by taking a position, or at least testing a position, that seemed to be more supportive of this case representing a status inquiry. The second part of your question was really about the necessity defense. This is Oregon is a state that has a new. I myself don't know much about it. I think it's supposed to be a new state statute that basically I think at least once in the arguments it was represented as trying to codify the Martin case. In other words, saying you can't criminally charge people for the unavoidable consequences of being human, for engaging in necessary life-sustaining activity. However, there are real issues, which also came up in the arguments, about whether the necessity defense would be applicable here. Some of the discussion centered around the fact that fines and fees, which are civil tools, would likely not apply. In other words, you couldn't seek undoing a civil infraction or a fine or fee, only something criminal. The reason the court was belaboring this and why it came up so often is because they are desperately interested in avoiding rendering a decision. That's if there's anything that you take out of the oral arguments today, it was that across the ideological spectrum on the justices, they were leaning towards something called constitutional avoidance. They want to avoid ruling where it's not necessary, and they'd like to see if there's a way to avoid rendering a decision in this case. And the if the Oregon's necessity defense could apply, then they can stand back and say, you know, our review was improvidently granted, and you know, we declined to render a decision here. And a number of justices were signaling their interest in taking that approach.
I was confused, and I guess I remain confused. If the avenue that the justices might find for saying, luckily we don't need to get our hands dirty with this, we can just say, no, for very proper reasons, this can be handled at the state level. I remain unclear if that's because of a longstanding necessity defense in Oregon law, or because of the way that Oregon lawmakers amended state statute just in 2021 in response to the Martin v. Boise decision. That's a relatively short new statute, and it says this: any city or county law that regulates the acts of sitting, lying, sleeping, or keeping warm and dry outdoors on public property that is open to the public must be objectively reasonable as to time, place, and manner with regards to persons experiencing homelessness. So is the idea that this new statute could give justices a way to say, you know what, for this Oregon-based case, we don't need to intervene because the legislature has already fixed it?
It could. What's interesting about that is that under the law already, even if they uphold Johnson, it is still the law. It is still the case that any jurisdiction in the Ninth Circuit can use reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions to deal with homelessness. And so while that's been codified into statute, it's currently the law across the Ninth Circuit, because that's an explicit case that the Martin v. Boise case said is okay. They said, look, we're not saying that cities can't use reasonable time, manner, and place restrictions. So even if they step back, essentially what they would be doing is not just saying that the Oregon statute, the necessity defense, which codifies Martin, is the law. They would be, you know, reinforcing that Martin is the law. Because Martin already allows reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. The difference in Grants Pass is that they had a statewide prohibition, citywide prohibition. They criminalized sleeping across the state. across the city. I keep switching between the Oregon statute and the Grants Pass ordinance. So what's at issue in Johnson is saying there is zero locations where someone can, even if they lack a reasonable alternative, there are zero locations right now in Grants Pass where it's legal for someone to sleep outside. And that is the definition of homelessness, is sleeping outside when you lack a safe and legal place to live. And so that's really the issue, is whether you can have a 24/7 citywide ban. The law of the land currently allows cities to impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, just like the Oregon statute codified.
What most stood out to you today, and if you had to make a bet right now, what are you expecting the court to release in late June?
Any good lawyer will always decline an invitation to bet. I will say that you could see some ideological line breakdowns between some of the conservative and more moderate or progressive justices. I think you'll see some close alliances between Sotomayor and Kagan, probably Jackson. And then you'll see some close alliances between Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh. It's hard for me to differentiate who was always talking, but I think I heard some more probing questions than I probably would have expected from Barrett. That sort of surprised me. But I think that to me, the biggest takeaway from the case that I didn't necessarily expect was how clearly the court was telegraphing that they would really like to avoid rendering a decision in this case, that they feel that these messy policy decisions are for city legislatures to deal with, city and state legislatures to deal with, not the place for the court to be making messy policy decisions. And that's consistent with our checks and balances.
Sarah Rankin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Rankin is an associate professor at the Seattle University School of Law, director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. She joined us to talk about and listen to some of the oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court today as the High Court took up the homelessness case out of Grants Pass.